Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm from the Public Defender's Office. I'm representing Mr. Peebler, who's actually in court with us today. My registration number is 34384. I want to start off by saying that after reading the state's response to my briefs, it occurred to me that there appears to be a misapprehension of the argument that I was making. I wasn't saying definitively in my brief that Mr. Peebler, at the time he was forced to go pro se, was in fact indigent. I was saying that there was the great specter of indigency throughout the pendency of his case. And I just want to make a few things clear right off the bat so we're all on the same page. This is a case similar to Ms. Jeffries in that it's the other side of the same coin. It's the right to be represented by a lawyer and to not have to go to trial by yourself if you don't want to. In this case, Mr. Peebler initially retained counsel, but after that, ineffective in my opinion, trial counsel continued the case at least 3, 4, 5, 6 times over a 9-month period. He just couldn't afford him anymore. So the first trial lawyer got off. He went to the public defender's office. Someone there told him he didn't qualify. He tried to retain another guy. The other guy said, look, he can't come up with my retainer fee. After that point, Mr. Peebler went pro se. But he repeatedly requested over and over and over again that he did not want to go pro se, that he couldn't understand why the public defender's office had rejected his application, and that he wanted to be represented because he was facing a very serious criminal offense that he actually went to prison for a while. And I just want to get everybody on the same page. We're talking about a guy that was faced with a definite prison sentence that he actually served a major part of if he went to trial, and lost. He repeatedly asked for representation and was denied that. He had to go to trial with his co-defendant, who was represented by a competent attorney, and throughout the trial, I read the transcripts, and it was pretty clear to me that the co-defendant was pointing the finger at him the whole time. So this is not just a matter of the statute and the court's failure to comply. This strikes at the very heart, the fundamental right to be represented and fairness in the criminal justice system.
Counsel, you began by saying you're not saying that he was indigent.
I'm not saying that he necessarily was. I'm saying that
if he's not indigent, then this whole issue is moot, right?
That's correct.
If he's not indigent at the time.
If the public defender's determination was in fact accurate, which we can't know now, then yes, he wasn't entitled to a public defender.
And I was unable to find in the record any indication of a copy of his application or anything in writing by anyone determining, the public defender determining that he was in fact not eligible. Is there anything in the record?
Find nothing either, and I would say that was the trial court's burden, as she had to comply with the statute 21-1-103. And as part of that, she needed to ask for a copy of that application and determine whether or not she agreed with it or whether she disagreed with it. She clearly didn't follow the statute in that respect. And I can tell you, I was a trial lawyer for many years down in the Springs office and up in the Denver trial office. And, you know, it might shock this court to find out, but the person who makes those indigency determinations is oftentimes a secretary that's just been there a couple weeks. So they, as far as I know, go through no training. It very well could have been flawed.
None of that's in the record, though, I think.
None of that's in this record, but it's, you know, my personal experience with the issue.
But your point is the trial court had an obligation to make specific findings with regard to whether or not she agreed or he agreed with the public defender's determination.
And I think that's absolutely clear from the statutory language of 21-1103. It says that the court shall determine whether the court agrees or not with the public defender's determination of non-applicability, and it also gives the court this outlet where if the court needs to investigate this further, it can have this collections investigator actually go out and do kind of an accounting just to make sure that we're not depriving someone who is actually indigent of the right to counsel.
So, counsel, is this a de novo review in effect for the trial court? Do they pull out their own calculator, ask the same questions, or look at the same questions that the public defender's office would be asking, punch in the same numbers, and then decide that they agree with the public defender's office?
You know, the case law isn't clear on that point, but it seems to me that the statute is saying that it is a de novo determination. In effect, the court would look at the application, see if there's any sort of glaring errors in it. Oh, we forgot to factor in his debts. We forgot to factor in his dependents, stuff like that. See if there are any glaring errors. I'm not sure that it requires the court to actually sit down with a calculator, but it certainly requires the court to at least look at the application or at least ask the defendant a lot of questions having to do with his indigency, and that clearly didn't happen here.
So the converse, then, of simply deferring to the public defender is what you believe was error in this case?
Well, and I'm not even sure that the court ever necessarily deferred to the public defender, because she never even stated that she agreed with their determination that he was not indigent, which is something that she needed to do per statute. But yeah, if you can regard that as a deference to the public defender's office, I think that, you know, before they are able to defer to that degree, she needs to undertake some sort of analysis, some sort of specific analysis of his assets, liabilities, debts, income, dependents, just those basic factors which gives you an impression of whether this person is indigent or not. And I would speak that the biggest proof that he was in fact indigent was the fact that he repeatedly requested for counsel and couldn't get it. He tried numerous times. I think it's in the record. It says every week he tried to retain counsel but was unable. He told the court, "I'm completely broke. I have a, quote, negative balance in my bank account. My expenses exceed my income." If that doesn't shout indigency, counsel, I don't know what does.
Counsel, as I understand the attachments that we're dealing with here, if his income exceeded 75% of the guidelines, it didn't matter what his expenses were, right?
Well, that's assuming that someone did the math correctly at the PD's office.
I understand that.
But I would agree with you.
Let's assume that he was making $50,000 a year. I have no idea what he was making. It wouldn't matter what his expenses were, what his debts were, anything. He would just be ineligible, right?
According to the Chief Justice directive, I would agree with that. The problem is we don't know what formula the person at the public defender's office used. We don't know how they calculated. We don't know what they neglected or overestimated or underestimated, and that was the trial court's obligation.
Well, what's there to calculate it? And it's not that difficult to figure out what his monthly income or what his yearly income is. You don't have to take into account.
Well, and I agree. That's why the trial court should have done it.
I see.
I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people. Bar number 38141. As the questions reveal, I think there are two main problems with the defendant's argument today. First, the indigency application was not included on appeal. This case, like Till and Velarde made clear, we have to presume that the trial court got it right, and I think that case, this case can be disposed of in that way. Two, assuming this court reaches the merits in this case, the central burden with the defense's argument.
How would the application even be in the court record that it could be included in a record to be certified on appeal?
Well, assuming they submitted one to the trial court, I'm guessing they could have included it or asked for it or submitted it on the record of appeal.
Well, wouldn't the defendant normally submit it to the public defender?
Yes. And they could also submit it to the trial court if they wanted a review of it. And on appeal, they presumably could have gotten it through the public defender's office. I don't know that for a fact, but I would assume that would be the case. Or created a record after the fact about it if they couldn't obtain it. Or at least made some averment of what his actual income was. And I think it's important to point out that at no point below or on appeal, and today, has the defendant ever asserted that he did fall below or within the income eligibility guidelines to be appointed counsel. I don't think that's a fact that's disputed before this court. And the second problem with the defense argument, I think, is that the review process counsel has been described today is quite simply not the directive that the Supreme Court wrote. I don't think we're having a disconnect so much about what the defendant's claim is, but more a disagreement at what indigent means. The defense reads the directive as providing a defendant's indigent if he or she is unable to practically afford counsel. Now, our Supreme Court certainly could have said that, but they didn't. Rather, they created a far more limited inquiry when they provided, quote, if the defendant's income is more than 75% above the income eligibility guidelines, the public defender will note that the defendant is ineligible for court-appointed counsel and will submit the form JDF 208 to the court.
There's nothing in the record that indicates that his income was more than exceeded guidelines by 75%. The only statement that I've seen in the record is that his income exceeded guidelines, but it doesn't say whether it exceeded guidelines by 75%.
I think twice he said, I agree with you, Judge, twice he said he was too high to qualify for a public defender. I think based on the record and the way the directive goes, if the defendant falls below 75%, if he's not 75% above the eligibility guidelines, you then fill out attachment A. There is no evidence that he ever filled out attachment A. So I think the only reasonable inference we can make here is that he was 75% above the income eligibility guidelines. I think in both times he talked with the trial court, he said his income was too high. Now, attachment A then goes into other factors, as defense counsel was saying, about expenses.
Was he saying that it was too high, or was he saying that the public defender's office is telling him that it's too high?
I'd say that I can't quite remember. It might be that the public defender's office was telling him too high. But I don't know how that changes the calculus in this case.
Well, part two of the analysis is subject to review of the court, and we spent a lot of time with your counterpart talking about the court's role in reviewing these. In your view, what is the court's role?
Well, when a defendant is 75% above, the only things we look at is his income and if he has dependents, which again, I think further supports the inference we can make from this record. Here, the trial court, and I don't know if it's looking at the defense application or not, but it asks him if the public defender got his income correct and if he had any dependents. Those are the only two variables we look at when we determine whether the defendant is precluded from getting counsel based on his income.
But she never asked him what his income was.
It verified that the public defender got it correct. But yes, the trial court never got the defendant's specific income. But she did verify that the income that he gave to the public defender in twice rejecting his application did get his income correct. And he had no changes. I'm sorry.
And then basically she just said, well, the public defender says you're too high, so that's it. I mean, there's no indication in the record that she made any independent determination, is there?
No, and I think under the directive, there doesn't need to be. All they have to do is verify that the public defender got it correct. Especially when here, I don't think it's contested at all that he wasn't 75% above the income eligibility guidelines. And though I understand this court's concern that there is no specific statement to that effect, I mean, it's never been raised, not below and not here, that the defendant was in fact was not 75% or more above the eligibility guidelines. And under the Chief Justice directive, that's it. And that's all the court has to do. It just has to verify the defendant is in fact that much, and it has no discretion under the current directive to appoint him counsel.
If he's more than 75.
If he's more than 75, yes. And I think based on the record here, it's the defendant's burden to provide the reviewing court with a record. And even if it wasn't, I think all the reasonable inferences here suggest that he was in fact 75% above the income eligibility guidelines. And with that said, the trial court had no discretion to appoint him counsel, and it satisfied its duty under the directive and the statutes. And if the court has no further questions, I ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with Mr. Lee here. There was absolutely no mention in the record about the number 75%. And anything that the court said, she was just going off what Mr. Peebler told her. Mr. Peebler would show up for court, say, Judge, the public defender wouldn't accept me, and she just didn't take it from there. There's no indication in the record that she actually made any sort of finding about what his income was, or even if the public defender got it right, so to speak, about him being 75% or what have you. She was purely, if you read the record, she was purely going off his indication that, Judge, went down to the public defender's office, filled out the application, and they denied me. It's not even clear to me that he was denied because of his income. When I look at one of those forms, I used to have to bring those to clients all the time. There's a ton of variables on there, and there's lots of reasons. Someone may have no income, but their assets may be in the millions. They wouldn't qualify. There's a lot of reasons why the public defender's office would deny or accept you just beyond your income. And there was no reference at below of anything about Mr. Peebler's specific income.
Mr. Huff?
Yes, sir.
I'm curious as to your requested remedy for a reversal of the conviction. It seems to me this is something that's readily verifiable. You look at the application, you ask a few questions. Why do we have to reverse the conviction if you're right? Why don't we just remand for a hearing and decide whether he met the guidelines or not?
Well, that's definitely one option. My only concern would be that if we did that, it'd be really tough to reconstruct his exact financial situation. And I guess it's been 2 or 3 years since then. I mean, to me, it'd be hard to come up with. It'd be like an auditing by the
IRS. We do that in litigation all the time. We go back and we calculate some of these damages that at a trial that takes place several years after the event.
Well, I'm not saying that's an unreasonable remedy.
He had paycheck stubs. If not, his employer could probably be subpoenaed. It should be doable.
Well, I'm not saying it's unreasonable. I'm just saying that there's every indication in the record that he was, in fact, indigent and should have qualified for representation. So we have that. So are we going to go through this hearing below just to find out that we should have appointed him a public or a trial attorney anyway? And also, if you look at the Steinbeck case that I cite in my brief, I actually go into depth in that one. They don't say that the remedy is to remand for specific determination. They say the remedy is here is reversal because he was denied.
But in Steinbeck, it was undisputed that his income was only $10,000, which was clearly below the guidelines. Here, we don't know. That evidence was not provided by anybody.
Well, my only point is that that's not an unreasonable request, is a remand for a determination. However, it would be hard for me, and I would think anyone else, to be able to reconstruct with any sort of verifiable accuracy their income as it was and their assets and their liabilities and their bills and all that from 2 to 3 years ago. But if this court thinks that that's the applicable remedy, I'm not going to dispute that. I'm just saying that according to the record that we have, it appears that he was in fact indigent. He was denied his right to counsel, and that in and of itself is structural error requiring reversal. That's all I have. Thank you.
And thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments, both of you. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes the docket for this afternoon's cases. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff shall so announce.
The court will be in recess, subject to call.